KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on a show that is unique both in substance and in logistics. For those of you that have been listening to Hearsay Culture since its inception over 5 years ago, you will know that initially I recorded this show when I was a fellow at the Stanford Law School, and I walked across the Stanford campus and recorded the show in studio at KZSU. In 2007, when I moved to North Carolina to start full-time teaching, I had to figure out a way to continue doing the show, and I decided that I could continue doing it, but I'd have to record in my basement. The result was, or as I've called it euphemistically, the East Coast Studios of KZSU. Since then, I have had very few guests that have actually shown up in the studio. In fact, if I think back, I think the number is zero since I moved to North Carolina. Well, today, we revisit the old days, as it were, because I have with me two of my colleagues from Elon University, from the law school, who are with me in studio to discuss their article, Constitutional Threats in the E-Commerce Jungle, First Amendment and Dormant Commerce Clause Limits on Amazon Laws and Use Tax Reporting Statutes. My colleagues from Elon are Professors Andy Hiley and Scott Gaylord, and I'm excited to have them on today, not only because they are with me in studio, as it were, but also because their article focuses on a very interesting issue that we have not explored on Hearsay Culture, and that's the issue involving online sales taxation, an issue which has received a good amount of press over the last couple of years, primarily because of efforts by the state of North Carolina, although some other states have also made efforts more recently to collect taxes from Amazon, the behemoth that has rewritten the book on e-commerce and which has aggressively fought efforts of state taxing authorities to collect information in order to assess the tax, which gets to the problem that we're going to be discussing today. Because interestingly, as Scott and Andy will discuss in more detail, the law actually requires that consumers pay use taxes for online purchases, and yet, even by a show of hands in a room full of technologists, you will find very few people who have actually paid the taxes. What to do about that problem and how to address it is the focus of their article, which is coming out in the fall in a North Carolina Law Review. And the problems are many. Not only are there logistical problems for the state taxing authorities, but as we'll be discussing, there are significant questions with regard to the First Amendment, not only in terms of speech, but in terms of privacy. The law itself, as Andy and Scott will discuss in more detail, isn't particularly favorable, it seems, either to the states or to, in my opinion, consumers in terms of dealing with this issue easily. But I think that Scott and Andy have come up with some interesting proposals to solve the problem. So I'm excited to have them on today to discuss an issue which, like I said, has not been a focus on Hearsay Culture, but one I think that goes more broadly towards how we conceive e-commerce and how we conceive internet communications in the context of a pretty basic governmental function like taxation. So Scott and Andy both teach at Elon University School of Law with me, where I'm an assistant professor as well. And I'm excited to have them on today. We are recording the show on May 31st, and the show is going to air today, so it's as fresh as it can get while still being recorded. Scott and Andy, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Dave, thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dave.
Let's start off, and I'll start with you, Scott, and this is a question I ask all my authors. Talk a little bit more about your background and how you became interested in this topic.
Sure. My background starts with philosophy, I guess. I've got a doctorate in philosophy before going off to law school, and then after law school, clerked for 1 year in the Federal Circuit Court, in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals down in Texas. And then practiced law for 7 years in litigation, doing largely corporate defense work, and then started with Elon University School of Law 4 years ago, And last year, Andy and I started talking about this project. Andy focuses more on tax and tax-related issues. My focus at Elon has been with respect to constitutional law generally and the First Amendment in particular. And so Andy had started doing some work on this project, and I'll let him talk a little bit more about that. And then we started talking and sort of fleshing out the both First Amendment speech and privacy issues that you mentioned, as well as Commerce Clause issues, and it just seemed to be a natural fit for us to work together on that project.
Andy?
Well, my background, after being a loyal listener to KZSU as a law school student at Stanford, was to return to my home state of North Carolina, where I also did a judicial clerkship for a federal district court judge here in the Middle District. I then went into practice for about 8 years, and 3 years ago moved over to Elon to start teaching. I focus on tax issues. I teach federal tax, income tax, corporate tax, partnership tax. But I have a particular interest in state tax issues because of my practice background. And so this topic's been of interest to me because of the financial situation that the states find themselves in. I'm sure you're familiar with that. But this year, this coming fiscal year, 44 of the 50 states anticipate significant budget shortfalls. So they're looking for revenues in whatever sources they can find them. And one place where they're concerned is collection of sales and use tax, particularly given the expansion of e-commerce. And so that's what brought me to this project. When I started looking into it, I focused in particular on a statute that had been enacted in Colorado where out-of-state retailers are required to disclose information about purchases by Colorado residents. And that implicated the First Amendment, and so it was natural for Scott and I to work together on this, given his background with the First Amendment and privacy issues.
So with regard to this project, gentlemen, it's the project itself is one that merges your two interests. And I'm curious, with regard to those interests, con law and taxation is not necessarily something, which and perhaps this reveals my ignorance, is something that you think about in tandem that much. What brought you together in terms of realizing that there was a core nexus problem here that needed to be addressed in an article?
Well, I think you've mentioned the word that brought us together, which is nexus. And that's where con law and taxation kind of meet, is what is the taxing authority, particularly of a state, particularly given the Dormant Commerce Clause limitations on a state's ability to reach out and require out-of-state retailers to collect or assess tax. And so that's the natural point where we connected. And then, again, given the statute that I was initially focused on, which was this Colorado statute, there were First Amendment issues implicated because of a potential disclosure of what is being purchased by the consumer. And so that's how we came together on this.
Oh, Scott, go ahead. Sure.
Well, for me, as we started talking, I think Andy and I first started talking about the Commerce Clause issues, but with the Colorado reporting statute, this idea of disclosure, when I teach my First Amendment class, we talk about compelled speech or forced disclosure. And there's an area, you know, with respect to taxation where we obviously disclose all sorts of information on a regular basis with respect to our tax returns. And there's sort of no question, okay, the government asks, we give it. And it's sort of interesting as to what's the foundation or basis for that. Does the government have the right? In lots of contexts, it can't force us to speak, to disclose certain information. But in the taxing arena, it certainly has. And it's just a noticeable dearth of case law or other support for setting the scope or parameters of what the government can or cannot ask for. And this particular project then in Colorado and then with what North Carolina has done with respect to Amazon sort of focused on that as well. So that brought the Commerce Clause and the First Amendment speech issues together for this article.
Now, let's do some basics. And before, I think I'll start with some basic questions about Amazon before we talk about some basic definitional issues with regard to taxation. Andy, maybe you're the best person for this. Describe for us what actually happens from a taxation standpoint when a purchase is made on Amazon versus, and we'll get into the details of the law later on, what should be happening basically when a purchaser makes a purchase on Amazon.
Well, what happens depends on where you live, first of all. Amazon, of course, is headquartered in Washington State. It has what they call fulfillment centers basically warehouses in about six or seven different states. But if you don't live in one of those states where Amazon has the physical presence, so for example, New York, North Carolina, there's no Amazon warehouse here. What happens is you make your purchase online, and Amazon does not charge or collect tax on that purchase. It doesn't have to, and that's based on some case law from initially dating back to the late 60s and then reaffirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court in the early 90s before the expansion of the internet. So, of course, what happens if you're here in North Carolina, you buy books or any other goods that Amazon sells, you're going to receive them without the state collecting any taxes on those books at the point of purchase. In other words, Amazon doesn't collect the sales tax on those goods. You, though, have an obligation, and we can talk about this in whatever level of detail you want, but you have an obligation still to pay taxes, which most people, it turns out, do not. And so the problem that the states are confronted with is that there have been estimates that nationwide about $8 to $10 billion worth of sales and use taxes are going uncollected each year on internet sales. Here in North Carolina, it's about $160 to $180 million per year, which the state's not receiving that it should. And in California, it's even worse. Estimates there are approximately $1 billion a year in uncollected taxes, which are owed to the state but not paid because of the precedent that the Supreme Court has set that requires a company to have a physical presence in a state before the state can force it to collect sales or use tax.
Scott?
Well, I think that's right. I think in terms of the size of the problem, in North Carolina, it's about $160 to $180 million that goes uncollected, but it's less than 4% of North Carolina taxpayers that ever report any use tax owed. And if you think about the growth of the internet over the last decade, two decades, and the number of people who are actually engaged in online purchases, it's somewhat difficult to believe that it's less than 4% of the people who are only less than 3% of North Carolinians and then nationally engaged in internet transactions where use or sales tax would not be collected on those purchases. So it's quite a big problem and important, sort of from a state perspective, with the budget shortfalls to try to find ways to do that. And then they run into the constitutional limits that we discussed in the paper.
And let me just mention this, Dave, because California has been tracking this quite closely. They're very concerned about this. They estimate the California Board of Equalization, which is their Department of Revenue, estimates that about 0.4% of taxpayers in California actually pay the taxes they owe on internet purchases. So you heard me correctly. It's 0.4%. Obviously, that's one of the lowest compliance rate, if not the lowest compliance rate, of any tax. And so the magnitude of the problem only appears to be escalating in the future as e-commerce continues to grow. And with $1 million of lost revenue annually in California, as they currently face about a $20 billion – excuse me, if I said million, I meant billion. Mm-hmm. They currently face about a $20 billion budget shortfall. They want to collect this if at all possible.
You know, it is a striking number. I mean, the amount of revenue left on the table – and the compliance, there's a jurisprudential question, which I'll skip, which is it really a law if 0.4% of the people are actually following it? But it leads to a larger question, which I think is one that initially is perplexing, and I think needs to be fleshed out a little bit before we get into the problem in more detail and some of the technological issues, which is why the law hasn't been enforced. What's the reason why, as the law stands, which still requires that consumers pay the tax, that we have 0.4% compliance in the case of California, and I'm sure the numbers are in the single digits anywhere else where it might exist?
Well, basically the problem is that there is no accountability for the taxpayer in the sense of any reporting mechanism. So if you think about when you earn wages, if you're an employee, you receive a W-2. The W-2 is provided to the IRS. You report on your tax return, you self-report your amount of wages, but there's a check out there in the form of a third party also disclosing that information to the IRS to confirm for the IRS that this is in fact the amount that you made. There is no analogous situation with respect to the use tax, and maybe we should go into a little bit of background as to what the use tax actually is.
Please.
Because, okay, people might not be familiar with that. Mm-hmm. Basically, About 45 states have sales taxes, and everybody's familiar with the sales tax. When you purchase a good in a face-to-face transaction, the seller collects the sales tax and then remits that to the state on your behalf, basically. In the late 30s, what states that had started enacting sales tax found was that their residents were crossing state lines in order to make purchases. So, for example, Oregon does not have a sales tax. California does. If you live along the California-Oregon border, you would cross the border to buy something in Oregon, therefore not have to pay taxes on it, and then bring it back to California and use there. In order to prevent that from occurring, every state that has a sales tax now also has a use tax. And basically what the use tax does is it taxes the use of a good purchased that has not been subject to sales tax. Okay, pretty self-explanatory according to its name. But again, the problem is, how does the taxing authority, in this case the state, discover that you've made the purchase? And in particular, when it's with respect to an internet purchase and the increased volume of sales that currently occur over the internet, there's no way for the state to discover that purchase unless it undertakes an individual audit. Okay, so there's effectively no compliance mechanism, and that's why the compliance rates are so low. What we discover is that if a taxpayer knows that there's a third party providing information to the government, which might allow the government to discover that taxes are owed, compliance goes way up. But that doesn't happen in the case of the use tax.
And the problem itself is one which is, I think, more endemic to the internet generally, from the standpoint of whether the law is adequate to deal with the technology. And this is something that we talk about on this show quite a bit. Certainly I teach whether, in fact, we need something called cyber law or whether the law as written can handle the technological differences, which is where I think we're going to go in a moment. You're listening to KZSU-FM Stamford and Hearsay Culture. And our guests today are Professors Scott Gaylord and Andy Hiley of Elon University School of Law. So let's talk in a little more detail, Scott, about some of the background here. And I think, I'll leave it to you gentlemen to decide who should cover the question. There's a case that you mentioned in the article Quill, which seems to form the nexus of the problem, no pun intended, or maybe pun intended. Tell us a little bit about Quill and how that relates to this issue.
Okay, I'm actually going to go back to one step before Quill, that's okay.
Sure.
In 1967, the Supreme Court decided a case called National Bellas Hess, where essentially you had a mail order company that the state of Illinois tried to require to collect use tax on sales that it made to Illinois residents. But it didn't have any physical presence in Illinois. It was, as I said, it was a mail order company. All it was doing was advertising in the state, making sales, and then sending the goods via common carrier or U.S. mail into Illinois. And what the Supreme Court said in that case was that under both the Due Process Clause and the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, Illinois could not require National Bellas Hess to collect use tax. Okay, fast forward now to 1992, and that's when the Quill case was decided. Same scenario, you may have heard of Quill, they're an office supply company. Again, making sales, in this case, into North Dakota. And they had about $1 million worth of sales every year in North Dakota. Again, they advertised in national publications, but they didn't have any physical presence in the state. And North Dakota wanted Quill to collect use tax on the goods that they were selling to North Dakota residents. What the Supreme Court did in the case was to essentially affirm Bellas Hess to the extent that the Dormant Commerce Clause, the court says, prohibits a state from requiring retailers to collect sales or use tax if the retailer has no physical presence in the state. Now, the court reached a different conclusion than the Bellas Hess case did with respect to the Due Process Clause. It said basically under due process, if you have minimum contacts with the state, then that suffices to create nexus for due process purposes. But with respect to the Dormant Commerce Clause, you actually have to have a physical presence, not just minimum contacts. And really, it seems that the decision, which was written by Justice Stevens, was intended to allow Congress to step in and exercise its Commerce Clause authority to determine how what the rules should be with respect to collection of sales and use tax by out-of-state sellers. Contrary to that expectation, that hasn't happened. Okay, Congress has not acted. And so the rule that continues to apply is the one from Bellis Hess and from Quill, which basically says, unless you have a physical presence in the state, that a state cannot require an out-of-state retailer to collect sales or use tax.
And I think with respect to that, it's, as Andy mentioned, the Quill decision was from the early 90s. And if you think back in terms of your listeners and your discussion of the need for cyber law, obviously things have changed dramatically with respect to e-commerce. And that's sort of the problem, that now all of a sudden you have in California $1 billion of unpaid sales and use tax, close to $200 million in North Carolina. And as the Internet's grown, we're still, if you will, stuck with a Supreme Court interpretation from the early 90s and talk of physical presence that really may not have application or maybe should not have application in contemporary society where so much is done online and the physical presence just isn't necessary in the same way. And that's one of the issues I think that we try to address, not directly from the technology standpoint, but from interpreting and analyzing this whole dormant Commerce Clause issue and the way the court first interpreted 1992 and suggesting that it needs to be read more broadly to give states greater latitude and authority to try to get at these taxes.
You know, and oh, I'm sorry, Annie, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to mention that both of those cases, Bellis Hess and Quill, were mail order companies. And as Scott mentioned, 1992 was the year that Quill was decided, which I think, ironically, was the first year in which there was commercial internet access in the United States. So clearly the court wasn't contemplating what would happen as far as internet commerce and e-commerce goes. But there's been a changing landscape, given the expansion of volume of sales over the internet.
Yeah, it's interesting again because we see these issues and these issues arose in the context of technology probably in its earliest stage when the courts were trying to figure out how to answer questions of personal jurisdiction and websites. And, you know, the famous case Zippo, which I know you're familiar with, and other cases attempted to figure out what it meant to do business in a jurisdiction from a personal jurisdiction standpoint. And, of course, the Zippo standard, which had this idea of active websites versus passive websites, has kind of slowly fallen into disfavor, not because it wasn't a workable standard, but because technology changed. And so these definitions do not mean the same thing as they did in the mid-90s. Before we get into the current case, the litigation that's going on between Amazon and the state of North Carolina, let me ask you a general perspective on that. I mean, you know, it kind of cuts to where we'll be going later, but in terms of the law as it exists now, can it, and I'm talking about tax law in particular, right, can it adequately address uses of technology as written? Or do we need to change the law on its periphery as opposed to at its core in order to address this problem?
I think the law is outdated, in particular because there's a clear distinction that you need to draw between due process and Commerce Clause. Okay, and the court makes this crystal clear in Quill, where it says there were sufficient contacts for there to be due process nexus, which is the jurisdictional nexus that you're talking about in Zippo. Mm-hmm. But then it goes on to say there's a very different issue that relates to the Commerce Clause, and that the Commerce Clause is not necessarily about fairness to the individual, whether they can be hailed into court, so to speak. It's about a systematic look at our national economic system and trying to prevent an undue burden imposed by the states on our national economic system. So interestingly, I think one of the bases for the decision in Quill was the court said, look, there are not just 50 different taxing regimes in the United States. Okay, you have all these different state taxes, but you also have local and municipal taxing authorities also. And so in a footnote 6 to the Quill decision, the court says There are over 6,000 taxing jurisdictions in the United States. If every one of them required out-of-state retailers to collect sales or use tax, that would place an undue burden, and I think the language they use is it would create a virtual welter of confusion for retailers.
A welter?
Yes.
Interesting.
Not a commonly used term.
Yeah, about to say.
A virtual welter.
What? I'm gonna reveal a little ignorance. How do you define a welter exactly?
I define it as a web of confusion.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
But that's my own definition without looking it up.
Yeah, that's a tricky word. Okay, go on, yeah.
Nevertheless, the point is, given the number of different taxing jurisdictions, the court said that this would unduly burden interstate commerce and therefore violated the Dormant Commerce Clause. So that's the basis of the decision. So going back to your initial question, is the law as it currently stands one that can adequately handle internet commerce? I think the answer is no, because we're stuck with this antiquated physical presence standard where more and more we have a virtual economic marketplace.
And I would just add, on top of that, in addition to the issues that Andy mentioned, I think there, as technology increases, you have these First Amendment issues that arise in new ways, in unforeseen ways. And I think the tax laws certainly just weren't geared to those at all at the time in terms of what states can do or the federal government, what information they can require, what is the impact of certain types of disclosure of electronic information, what types of data can be mined from that, and how that might affect privacy or speech rights as we go forward. And now that certainly goes beyond what we've done in this paper, but I do think it's an important issue and one that the tax laws as currently written just haven't had to deal with, and we see cases now starting, like the ones out of North Carolina that's the focus of our paper, that starts drawing on those issues. And in Colorado, there's been litigation, and it's ongoing. They're actually focused more on the Commerce Clause, and they've agreed to litigate just the Commerce Clause issues, but the First Amendment issues are lurking in the background, if you will, waiting to be explored and see what the courts will do with that and the impact of technology on what information and in what forms that can be disclosed or be required to be disclosed by the state.
We're chatting with Professors Andy Hiley and Scott Gaylord of Elon University School of Law and KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU-FM, which is a non-commercial and non-profit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the show and to make a voluntary offering as opposed to one compelled by law, which is what we're discussing today. So we're asking for your voluntary compliance and hope that we get better than 0.4% so we can stay on the air. Gentlemen, let's turn directly to this lawsuit, which interestingly is a declaratory judgment action brought by Amazon preemptively based upon what appear to be, from your article, threats by the state of North Carolina that it would bring action. So for the non-lawyers in the audience, and it was a declaratory judgment, correct?
Yes.
A declaratory judgment action, in effect, is an action brought by a party asking the court to declare certain rights of a party or certain powers of the party to act in a certain way. So tell us a little bit about this action, because I think this gets directly to the constitutional issues, Scott, that you've mentioned, as well as the failures in the law, Andy, that you've talked about. So tell us about this action and where it currently stands.
Okay. Well, let me give you a little context for it first, if I could. Mm-hmm. So the states have been confronted by this loss of revenue that they feel they're entitled to receive under the use tax statutes, but they're unable to collect because they have no way to either get the out-of-state retailers to collect it or to really force the purchasers to pay the use tax that they owe. So back in 2008, New York was the first state that passed a so-called Amazon law, which basically was an effort to get the retailer, despite not having a physical presence in the state, to collect the use tax. And the way it did that was that if a company like Amazon had a contract with another website company which linked to Amazon, and Amazon paid that company a commission for sales that it made through that link. Then the statute basically creates a presumption that that in-state company with the link is soliciting sales on behalf of Amazon, which establishes a physical presence. And the first states to pass these laws were New York, North Carolina, and Rhode Island. What happened after those laws were passed is that Amazon sued in New York to find that the statute was unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause. And what it did in North Carolina and Rhode Island was it broke its relationship with those in-state companies that provided the links. Okay, so North Carolina was at the front edge of trying to increase its use tax collection, but it essentially failed in its effort to do that with enactment of this Amazon law, because Amazon just said, okay, if that creates a physical presence for us, we'll just terminate the relationship with those companies, and therefore we have no physical presence. And ironically, you know, what we find is that the state may in fact be losing revenue because of that that Amazon law, since those companies, which would have otherwise generated income from the commissions from Amazon, no longer generating that income. So North Carolina, of course, is very upset about this situation. What it wanted to do was to, again, try to increase use tax compliance. And Amazon is seen as kind of the poster child for a company that's created a business model to minimize the amount of taxes that it and its consumers have to pay. So what the state did was it audited Amazon ostensibly to determine whether Amazon itself owed any sales taxes to the state. And in the course of that audit, it issued an information request to Amazon, which was extremely broad, and asked Amazon to disclose to the state all the purchases that North Carolina residents had made and all information relating to those purchases over a five-year period. Amazon refused to provide the information initially, but then eventually what Amazon did was it provided all the information requested by the state of North Carolina with respect to sales over a five-year period, with the exception of the identity of the purchaser. So, you know, it would say we've, you know, sold these books. It would give the title of the books. You could receive all the information about the cost, what the product was, but it did not provide the information linking those purchases to the end purchaser. Now, North Carolina, you know, in asking for this information, it appears, was on the one hand trying to determine whether Amazon might have had any sales tax liabilities itself, maybe trying to create some pressure to get Amazon to voluntarily collect use tax on sales it makes into North Carolina, and also potentially checking into what about North Carolina residents. Are there North Carolina residents who we can get information about who aren't paying their use taxes, who we might pursue on an individual basis? Amazon claimed that this violated the First Amendment rights of their clients and customers and refused to provide the identifying information. But that issue obviously created significant First Amendment concerns, and that's where maybe Scott can come in here and talk about that to some extent, because what Amazon did is it asked a federal court in Washington to step in and to in fact declare that the information request it had received was overbroad and unconstitutional under the First Amendment.
And Scott, before you pick that up, Anne, I do want to follow up with one question. Amazon creating a business model that is designed to minimize its tax exposure makes it no different than any other business that exists and is designed to minimize tax exposure. So what's different about Amazon's situation as compared to any other entity that finds a loophole in the law,
right,
and exploits it?
Well, okay, you're right to the extent that you know, there's case law and there are famous quotes by Supreme Court justices saying that you have no patriotic duty to maximize your taxes, okay? And that's an accepted position. But what's different maybe about Amazon's model is that it's benefiting from its knowing noncompliance by its consumers with the tax laws, okay? So, in fact, again, Amazon itself is not responsible for collection or payment of the use tax. It can't be made responsible under the existing Supreme Court case law, Quill in particular. But it's in effect a beneficiary of the consumer's failure to pay the use tax. All right? And, you know, whether there's some moral implication to that, and whether Amazon is doing something wrong by benefiting from somebody else not paying the taxes. We can leave that to the philosophers. But the states are upset, of course, because they're owed these taxes. The easiest and most efficient way to collect them is to have the retailer collect them rather than the individual consumer, particularly when there's no check other than an individual audit to ensure that the consumer is, in fact, paying the taxes that are owed. So I think that's maybe the difference with Amazon's business model and any other legitimate tax planning strategy out there, which is this model depends on noncompliance, not by Amazon itself, but by the third-party consumers.
And I would just add, as a practical matter, the reason Amazon is the target is given, as you mentioned, Dave, just the size of Amazon. And in the five-year period for which the Department of Revenue in North Carolina sought information, North Carolinians had engaged in roughly 50 million transactions with Amazon. So you have one company that's providing 50 million transactions. There's a big chunk of the use tax revenue that might be available there that the state can go after. Now, it's not all 160 to 180 million, certainly, but it makes them a prime target. And so they're trying to take advantage of a loophole or get out, but it's a significant chunk of the money that North Carolina seeks to recapture.
Let me just also mention, this is a little bit of a different topic, but I think it, again, gives context to the dispute here. There's actually a federal statute that was enacted in 1959, which says that a state cannot enforce its corporate income tax against an out-of-state company if all that company does in your state is solicit sales, okay, which is what Amazon does. So effectively, Amazon is able to sell its goods without having to collect a sales tax and thereby get a benefit over its competitors who have, you know, stores in the state and do have to collect sales tax. It also is not paying any state corporate income tax because of this. It's called PL 86-272, statute passed in 1959, of course, well before the internet and e-commerce.
And so, Scott, the constitutional concerns here, I mean, Andy certainly has referred to the Amazon's failure to meet the request in the level of detail, particularly, right, the anonymity issue. So how does the First Amendment and broadly the Constitution figure into this pending litigation and the issue more broadly?
Sure. I think with respect to the Amazon action in Washington, Amazon asserted its own First Amendment rights, that it had no obligation to disclose this information and it would violate its rights in terms of compelled speech. That issue, I think, interestingly, really was not a focus for the district court or its opinion. So that's issue sort of still out there. What is the proper scope of First Amendment protection to the individual who is receiving the request? As Andy mentioned, this takes place in the context of an audit of Amazon itself, and no one questions that the DOR has the right, the Department of Revenue has the right to audit taxpayers and to check and see whether or not they're meeting their obligations. But I think this case raises the issue of what are the outer limits. Although the taxing authority is extremely broad under the federal and state constitutions for government to collect taxes, are there any limits? And so that's one issue. Again, not litigated in that action. The First Amendment issue that was litigated was Amazon's raising the First Amendment rights of North Carolinians, of the consumers who purchased those products, and whether or not the government could receive both the specific products that were purchased as well as the particular identities of the purchasers, such that they knew that I purchased a particular book from Amazon on a given date for a certain amount. And given the breadth of the information request, as Andy mentioned, all information regarding consumers, the district court ultimately held that that violated the First Amendment, that it infringed on the speech rights of consumers in particular, speech rights interpreted broadly to include privacy rights of the consumers, that the government need not have that information. One, it had enough information. Amazon had given a whole bunch of information. So within the context of the audit, Amazon didn't need that to determine what Amazon's tax liability would be. But in addition, it seems to suggest that that would violate the privacy rights of these consumers. Now, what is, as you mentioned, is a declaratory judgment action, and Amazon asked to declare the rights of Amazon, saying we have no obligation to disclose this information at all. I think, interestingly, the district court said, well, no, hold on. We're not going to grant Amazon the relief that it requested exactly. What we're going to say is you, the Department of Revenue for North Carolina, are not entitled to the specific books, the specific titles, and the specific names of the individuals who purchased those. But I authorized the Department of Revenue to issue a new request, a more narrow request that would ask for the identities of purchasers and then just whether or not they purchased generically expressive materials like a book or a video. And the court held that that was consistent with the First Amendment. And what we sort of explore in our articles, both requests, why do both fail? The court is a bit quick in its analysis. And we contend that the second request also raises First Amendment issues, particularly if you're purchasing books from retailers or remote retailers that sell exclusively expressive materials that may be political, that may be non-mainstream. And as a result, the government will still know that you're purchasing certain types of materials from certain retailers.
And Dave, just to be clear then on the procedural posture of the case, the district court in Washington did in fact grant summary judgment to Amazon and found that the information request that the North Carolina Department of Revenue had issued requesting all information relevant to sales over this five-year period was overbroad and violated the First Amendment. But then it followed up in the opinion, as Scott said, by saying you could narrow this request and instead of asking for specific titles, ask for a category of goods and identity of the customer, and that would comply with the First Amendment. And that's where we look into in our paper about whether, in fact, that request has some First Amendment issues associated with it as well.
Yeah, and since you mentioned it, then we're getting, by the way, to what I call the unfair portion of the show, which is where I start asking questions that you may not have enough time to answer, because we have about 12 minutes or so left, and I do want to cover your solutions. But since you mentioned Andy, and I think it's important, I'm not familiar, and perhaps you are, what the categories would be. If a category is book, colon politics, that also, it seems to me, might be a concern. So do you have any information? Has Amazon told the court or revealed anywhere what those categories look like?
Well, Amazon actually, they have two different systems of categorizing the goods that they sell. The old system, which is the information they first disclosed, had individual product information. So you could literally find, based on a number, exactly what the product was. What the court said was, instead go with these more generic categories, not books, colon, politics, but books, food, household goods, these sort of items that really the reason why the Department of Revenue would even want that information
right.
is because we have different tax rates for different categories of goods. And really it boils down to, at least in North Carolina, we have a general tax rate that applies to everything except for food. Mm-hmm. And as you know, you can buy anything from Amazon now, mm-hmm. including food. And so you really only have two categories that you need. One is the full tax category, and the other is food, which is taxed at a right. lower rate, at least with respect to North Carolina. But the court, in its opinion, basically said, you can't get the specific information, but if you request instead this generic information such as books, movies, household goods, foods, that complies with the First Amendment.
Although from perhaps, unless I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, we wouldn't even need to get into that level of detail. Why couldn't it just be food and non-food?
Well, that's exactly right. And we really haven't spoken at all in detail about this Colorado reporting statute, which is, again, part of the focus of our paper. But in that statute, essentially, what Colorado is doing is saying to retailers who don't collect sales or use tax, you have to report to the Department of Revenue in Colorado annually the amount of purchases made by each individual consumer each year. And it doesn't require any sort of category. Okay, it's just the dollar figure. And then the Department of Revenue, based on that, can assume that the purchaser has purchased goods which are taxed at the highest sales tax rate. Okay, and that, to some extent, mitigates some of the concern about being able to identify what it is people are purchasing. Now, there's still implications potentially with the First Amendment there based on who is the seller. Okay, if it's a...
Because this doesn't just apply to Amazon.
No, you're correct. It doesn't just apply to Amazon. The Colorado reporting statute does not just apply to Amazon. So if it's a seller of what's called, in the First Amendment parlance, expressive materials, and you could maybe identify what type of expressive materials those are based upon the identity of the seller, then it might be just as good as disclosing what the purchase is based on who the seller is. And that's the real nub of the First Amendment issue.
And as part of that, I think it does get to the idea of, can you separate that out? And so we talk about the possibility of distinguishing between general retailers, something like Amazon that sells all sorts of products, and specialized expressive material retailers that sell only books or videos, and whether that will make a difference for the First Amendment. But I think on top of that, I mean, another part of the North Carolina Amazon case that we didn't mention is, as part of that case, seven individuals represented by the ACLU intervened in that suit and claimed that their First Amendment rights were violated. Amazon claimed generally their rights. They stepped into the case and said, hey, we want to be represented. We want to explain why our rights are violated as well. And you have issues possibly even in that situation. Now, to what extent the courts will credit this going forward, but you had one of the plaintiffs say, look, I've had problems with my marriage. I had an abusive husband who became addicted to various substances. I got self-help books on these issues. I don't want the government knowing about it. I don't want my spouse knowing about it. And if I get audited or I have to disclose and all of a sudden it shows $200 in purchases from Amazon, I don't want my husband to know that. I need to be able to do this for my own security. I don't want my friends knowing it. I don't want the government knowing it. Could that be sufficient and create a problem? Even though you have a generic category, you still have expressive materials at the end of the day, and someone could, and if you're filing jointly, husband say, wait a second, what's this for? Where do these monies come from? And all of a sudden, you reach a similar problem. And it gets to another issue that we haven't talked about expressive, but we talk about in the paper, as to what's the standard. If the First Amendment is triggered, then is it, what base is that? The courts, some of the district courts that have talked about this, one in particular talks about frosting keyboards across America, you know, this chilling effect on speech. If the big, you know, big bad government can know about this, well, that may be true, but how do you tell? Is it a reasonable person standard? Is it if you can just find somebody who's concerned about it? And that's an open issue, I think, that has broad significance going forward, not only for the tax issue, but generally in terms of privacy issues, and the courts have not resolved that yet.
And Dave, I have to say, as a tax lawyer and a tax professor, I was surprised at the extent of First Amendment protections that are available. And, you know, you can understand the state's position. The state is saying, we are seeking to collect these revenues that we're owed, right? And the consumer's position is, I don't want to disclose and I shouldn't have to disclose to you what it is that I purchase. But I was surprised at the extent of First Amendment protections that are afforded to consumers. And, you know, I think it's a tension that's going to continue as the states try to maximize their collection on use tax.
You know, it's, you know, as someone from an internet perspective, you know, I have concerns about consumers having to basically take on the responsibility of correcting a problem that appears to be in the law. There's also an issue of real anonymity with regard to the data, which I think you've addressed in your discussion just now about what Amazon really needs, because at least from my perspective, and you know, there are cases that support this, data can easily be anonymized. And in other words, data can be reassembled, can be aggregated in a way to actually reveal quite a bit of information with regard to the individual, even though it's been labeled anonymous. I recognize that neither of you are technologists or internet law scholars, but I'm curious, and we don't have a lot of time, so I do want to get to your solutions very quickly, in less than a minute. Any quick thoughts on that issue?
Well, it's always a concern that information is going to be disclosed or leaked, either intentionally or accidentally. And we've seen with respect to some information that's disclosed to the government in some states, for example, DMV information has been sold to third parties, which allows for marketing. There are statutes that prohibit that with respect to tax information. So there is statutory protection. Now, does that address the issue that you raised completely? No, because any information, I assume, that has to be reported and is done so electronically may be disclosed at some point. But if all that's being requested, again, looking at it from the state's perspective, is the amount of purchases that are being made by a consumer from a seller, well, you can't ask for less and still effectively enforce the tax. And we do have this tax on the books. Although it's not complied with generally, and we see these abysmal compliance rates, it is a tax on the books that the states are entitled to enforce. And so the question is, how can they do that without, you know, stepping across a boundary with respect to the Dormant Commerce Clause? How can they do that with respect to the First Amendment issues that are out there? And how can they do it in a way that still protects the consumer from disclosure of information to third parties, whether or not it's a violation of the Constitution, but just from a practical perspective? And the states are trying to work that out still.
Intensely practical question before we spend the last couple minutes on to discuss your solutions a little bit. Are you aware, or have the states said what they ultimately intend to do, assuming they get this information? I guess the intensely practical question is, can North Carolina taxpayers and other state taxpayers expect a bill saying you owe us taxes of this amount going back to 2004?
Well, the state has never expressed exactly what it would do.
He's talking about North Carolina?
Yes, yeah. North Carolina. What it would do with the information with respect to individual consumers. Theoretically, it could go to those consumers and say, you made $1,000 worth of purchases from Amazon in 2006. You didn't pay any taxes on that. You didn't report any taxes owed. But in fact, you owed them, and now you must pay them. Whether it would practically do that, I think, is very unlikely given the small dollar figures that will be at stake for any individual consumer. I think the more likely scenario is the state is trying to get this information to make life a little bit harder on Amazon so that it might voluntarily elect to collect sales tax. Some companies do that. Netflix. Netflix, you know, is another model of a company where they don't have a physical presence in many states, but they collect sales and use tax in every state. And they say this story that Amazon tells about how difficult it is to comply in these 6,000 different jurisdictions is bogus, because there are third-party providers out there now, and there's software that makes this not a difficult or expensive task to do.
And just one other thing, Dave, I think to see the Colorado reporting statute type model where you have sort of mirroring what happens with the W-2 that Andy talked about at the beginning of the program, where a third party sending in that information. If consumers know that Amazon and others are reporting this information, the trend has been that the compliance rate goes up. So not only do you go after the big companies, get them to do what they can, get some more revenue from there, but also you have this other pressure on consumers so that you can get the less than 4% rate in North Carolina, hopefully up significantly, at least from the state's perspective.
The as I said, unfair question, because you have about 2 minutes to answer it. The article is available on SSRN, and again, we're chatting with Professors Andy Eiley and Scott Gaylord of Elon University School of Law, authors of the article "Constitutional Threats in the E-commerce Jungle," which you can find on SSRN. Gentlemen, in 2 minutes, the solutions. I know you mentioned basically two. Reporting statute and using federal law. Perhaps you could take a minute quickly on each one.
Okay, I'll talk about using federal law first, and I'll let Scott address the reporting statute more. There has been an effort at the federal level to get Congress to actually exercise its Commerce Clause power, as essentially the court invited it to do in Quill, to define who exactly needs to collect sales and use tax so that the states aren't going to be in a situation where they're enacting these individual laws like Colorado has, or forced to pursue individual retailers like North Carolina has with respect to Amazon, but instead to have a uniform system. And that uniform system would be based on, this is a larger topic, an idea that the states had after Quill, which is we'll design a compact called the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Compact, which will make this as administratively feasible and easy as possible on the retailers. And states which enter into that compact and thereby make their laws as uniform as possible will get the benefit then of Congress enacting a statute that says if you're a member to that compact, then even if a company has no physical presence in your state, they must collect the use tax for you.
stuff.
With respect to the Colorado reporting statutes, I think we suggest that North Carolina may want to pursue that as well. There's ongoing litigation there. That's focused, as we mentioned, primarily on the Commerce Clause issues. Our paper tries to explain why there are good reasons for a court to hold that these reporting statutes pass Commerce Clause issues or survive Commerce Clause scrutiny. But the First Amendment still poses an interesting problem there with respect to privacy. And one way to start going about making it consistent with the First Amendment is to distinguish between general retailers like Amazon and specialized retailers. But there are a lot of other issues, privacy issues you've mentioned about data and what information can be mined from that. I think the more that individuals can make that case and explain the threat there, then the more pressure that's going to put on the court to have very broad First Amendment protections and apply that in these contexts as well.
Professors Scott Gaylord and Andy Hiley, co-authors of the article Constitutional Threats in the E-Commerce Jungle, First Amendment and Dormant Commerce Clause Limits on Amazon Laws and Use Tax Reporting Statutes, an article that's forthcoming in the North Carolina Law Review. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. This is a challenging issue, and like I said, one that we don't spend a lot of time on the show, but certainly I think we'll be following this litigation, and I invite you gentlemen back down the road in studio to follow up and let us know where things are going. Thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thanks for having us, Dan.
Yes, thank you for having us.
I'm happy to mention that there are a number of great guests coming up in the summer quarter on KZSU. For those of you who listen to KZSU, you know that this is the last show for this quarter on KZSU. Hearsay Culture will be an interim, or KZSU will be an interim, and KZSU will be on hiatus during most of June. But I'm excited about the guests coming up in July and August. Among them, Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants, Andrew Renz, Research Associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School, Professor Michael Risch of Villanova University School of Law discussing his research on patent trolls, Professor Peter Gallison of Harvard University discussing his documentary Secrecy, Professor Susan Shirk of the University of California, San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China, Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University discussing privacy in context and other work that she's done recently in media studies. Professor Arkon Fung of the JFK School of Government at Harvard University discussing his work on transparency and technology. Professor Marcus Boone of York University discussing his work taking a philosophical and ultimately a very theological view of copying and copyright in his book In Praise of Copying. Professor John McGinnis of Northwestern University Law School, author of the forthcoming book Accelerating Democracy, and Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of Common as Air. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live Tuesdays at 4:30 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU. That time is subject to change next quarter, so stay tuned for that. But you can also get the show by podcast. There are a number of ways to get the podcast. You can go to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page by typing Stanford Center for Internet Society in iTunes, where you can get all of Hearsay Culture's shows as well as events occurring at Stanford Law School through the center. You can get the show by picking up the RSS feed for Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And lastly, you can also get the show at hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 140-odd shows as well as look at the upcoming schedule of guests. Thank you again for listening today to Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming and have a great day.